Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection from KSKA and Anchorage Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Along with the rise of the automobile, video screens, and relatively inexpensive food comes a problem, obesity. Today's guest has a recent report to the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, which includes the following quote: aside from 15% of currently obese, another estimated 20% of children who aren't currently obese will become obese as adults if the current national patterns continue. Along with obesity is a 10 times increased risk of diabetes and its complications, and an increased risk of heart disease, cancer, arthritis, and other unhealthy outcomes. The current and future cost of this new threat to our economy is the topic of today's program, and our guest is Muhsin Ghatabi. He is a PhD, assistant professor of economics at the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research, where he's been for the last 3 years. Dr. Ghatabi, welcome to Line One.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start. This is a broad-reaching topic, but let's be somewhat narrow at the beginning and try to understand a little bit about ICER, what the Institute of Social and Economic Research is all about and where their funding comes from. And then we'll talk about your project and its funding and mm-hmm. results.
Sure. ICER is a public policy institute that does a lot of research in far-reaching areas, all of which hopefully improving the well-being of Alaskans. We have people that are doing research on fiscal issues. Myself, I'm a regional and health economist, which means I do a lot of economic impact studies. I look at a lot of health care issues. We have people doing work on energy, fisheries. And so as long as it has a public policy component, as long as we think it improves the understanding and or moves the conversation forward, it usually falls under the helmet of what ICER does.
Who's interested in the results of ICER? Is it the legislature? Is it policymakers? Is it payers of healthcare premiums?
Are we talking about this report in particular, in general?
Let's take general about
ICER. I would say all of the above, yeah. Right? And so all of our, I think that one of the significant advantages of having an institute like ours is that all of our work is made public on our website. And so anybody that is potentially interested in either learning more or a legislator that is in the process of making a decision about one of these relevant issues can access a lot of the good work that's being produced. And so we would like to think that we're educating the public and we're making sure that they're well aware of the science that's being produced by the researchers there.
And just a little bit of research that I did into ICER, this was established with some money from the legislature, but how is the year-to-year cost of maintaining that?
So a significant portion of our funding, about two-thirds of it, comes from grants and contracts. We get about a third of our funding from the legislature. The rest of it is essentially us writing proposals, seeking out funding, whether it's from state, federal agencies, or interested parties that reach out to us that want a specific question answered. And so that varies, obviously, depending on the pots of money that are available out there, depending on the research interests of the people that are ICER at any one point in time. And so, yeah, so we're this quasi-public-private institute.
And the state of Alaska came to you and wanted to know a little bit about some costs of obesity.
Yes. So as you've stated, I have a PhD in economics, and so I do work on health issues but also on regional issues. And so we had been in conversation with the Department of Health and Social Services about essentially an alternative way to quantify the costs of obesity. I think that qualitatively everybody is aware that obesity has become a problem. Everybody is aware that it is now referred to as an epidemic. It's something that no longer just affects a small minority. It's become a far-reaching problem. And it's starting to affect children as well. And so in order to potentially inform people who are allocating funding for anti-obesity policies, it's important for us to try and quantify just how big is the issue and how many dollars are actually being, quote unquote, wasted as a result of the obesity increase that we've witnessed over the last 30 years.
I started the conversation with just some of my personal thoughts that the rise in obesity has multiple factors. Food has become more plentiful. It's cheaper. We can argue about the quality that's available. But we've also at the same time become less, more sedentary. When I grew up in the 50s, we were never at home during the day, and now kids are at home sitting down watching something a large percentage of the day. So, and weight gain and weight loss is all about energy, and so we're taking in more energy and burning up more energy, or less energy, I mean. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yeah. I think that all of those factors, I mean, it's very, very challenging to decompose which of the factors you've cited or the relative importance of every single one of those factors. Environmentally, we're seeing that food takes a considerably less amount of time to prepare, right? Which means that the energy or the time necessary to prepare a meal has gone down considerably. The number of two-earner households has increased substantially, which means the time that people have to prepare healthy meals has decreased. We're seeing commute times have gone up considerably, which means that the amount of time available for exercise has decreased. We've seen changes in preferences. And so there's a number of factors. You've cited a few of them. So we're exercising less, we're eating more, and we're eating the wrong type of food, if we want to say that, meaning that it's less nutritional because at the cost of convenience, right? Mm-hmm. And so, so now the question becomes, as a result of these changes, what are the actions? A, you know, how much is the obesity epidemic costing us, and can we reverse it?
So one of the real questions, is it true that obesity leads to worse outcomes? I mean, it seems a simple question to ask, but sometimes the simplest questions, we just have jumped to the conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
Is it make sense to you? Is the evidence good enough to suggest that as we get overweight, we're going to have increasing unhealthy outcomes?
Yes. To me, the association, there is a causal association between increased obesity rates and higher likelihood of chronic conditions, right? And so there is a pretty severe association between obesity, diabetes, heart disease, strokes, and those tend to be conditions that are very costly and are actually ones that have the highest out-of-pocket costs as well. And so in my mind, and based on all the work that we've done and a lot of other people have done, it's no longer just a correlation of those people tend to be the same ones that have a lot of these chronic conditions. There seems to be an actual causal nature from obesity to the conditions just cited.
And so why would the health department want to understand this?
So they're undertaking a number of efforts, right, to educate the public, to make sure that we're doing, that our children are doing some of the things that we've been discussing, meaning exercising, getting their 60 minutes of exercise, that their parents are aware of some of the things they can do to curb obesity. But the conversation, as you know, almost always comes back to why does this matter? From a legislative standpoint, from a taxpayer standpoint, how much is this costing us? Should we be investing in anti-obesity policies? This report does not attempt to do that, but what it does is it shifts the conversation into let's actually try and quantify the issue and make sure that when we're having these conversations, hopefully this becomes something that we can use to say, oh, is investing $1 million potentially enough? enough, or is it that we can invest $100 million and even if the benefits are small, we're actually still better off in the long run? Because from a policymaking standpoint, having the myopic view of any dollar that's invested in an anti-obesity policy is potentially wasteful if we don't achieve the outcomes we want, only looks at that particular investment at that one point in time. But once we look, once we take a longer run view, you notice that not doing anything is actually not an option.
Let me remind listeners, you're listening to Line One, your health connection. My guest today is Dr. Mohsin Ghatabi. He is a healthcare economist, we'll call him. He's definitely an economist, and he's definitely working on health issues. He's assistant professor at the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research. And our topic today is the current and drawn-out costs of obesity to Alaskans. If you've got comments or questions, there's a couple of ways you can get in touch with us over the next 50 minutes or so. Our local number, 550-8433, 550-8433. Our email address is line1@alaskapublic.org. And we also have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. Dr. Ghatabi, then tell us exactly what the state came to you with, what was the proposal, and how you went about doing this.
The proposal was, can you essentially, A, quantify the cost of childhood obesity and adult obesity in Alaska, and can we potentially look at it in certain age segments, and can we simulate, in other words, can we see what would potential cuts in obesity rates actually save if we were to undertake, for example, successful policies that do result in decreases in obesity rates? Can we actually monetize those decreases in some way? And so the task was essentially to, let's attempt to find what data we have available and let's undergo these exercises to quantify the current costs, actually make sure that we can forecast this cost forward or project it forward, meaning say, let's follow a particular cohort of children over 20 years and see how these costs accumulate. And then let's try and say, all right, if, for example, we were to reduce obesity rates for children between the ages of 12 and 19 by 1%. What does that actually mean from a monetary standpoint? Again, we make absolutely no attempt to go after a particular intervention or anything like that, but it's one step forward, in my opinion, that at least gives the conversation quantitative tools to potentially promote talking about this conversation.
Yeah, for example, I guess one reason would be is if it costs me $2 per child to do this intervention, and I'm only going to save $1.50. Is it, you know, that's then you have to really have the conversation.
Absolutely, and so without this as a first step, this notion of a break-even analysis or making sure that we understand whether or not this would be, from a cost-benefit standpoint, actually attractive, you really can't do that, right? And so this, while broad, while making a number of assumptions due to the paucity of data and the time constraints, at least gets us to the point where we understand that even relatively small decreases in obesity rate can, in the long run, save us a lot of money, which means that from a policymaking standpoint, we can't really afford to not do anything because that's incredibly costly. And this is, again, very specific, simply talking about direct costs, which, as you know, and I'm assuming a lot of your listeners know, are simply a very small portion of the overall costs associated with obesity.
Mm-hmm. All right. So how'd you go about doing this?
It was an undertaking that ended up being quite difficult because, unfortunately, we really don't have a lot of very good data. So what I tried to do, and we ended up succeeding, at least doing it fairly well, was first, let's get obesity rates by age and gender for Alaska children, adolescents, and for Alaska adults. Let's make sure that we have expenditures or excess medical costs by age and gender, meaning from the literature, we know that an obese individual spends more on medical expenditure than their non-obese counterpart, meaning controlling for everything else, or let's assume there are two individuals who are identical, and the only difference is that one is obese, the other one is not. The literature finds quite consistently that on average, the number we end up using for adults, for example, is that the obese individual spends somewhere close to $1,400 more a year on medical expenditures than their non-obese counterpart. And so the exercise ended up being fairly simple in that let's find the percent of individuals who are obese by age and gender, and let's multiply those number of individuals by this excess medical difference, right? And so, and these differentials in expenditures vary by age as well, right? And so let's assume that, for example, there are 30,000 individuals between 12 and 19, 10% of whom are obese, right? And so you multiply that 3,000 by the differential, and then that's basically your overall cost of excess medical costs that are quote unquote attributable to obesity. And so we did this for the year of 2012, and I did it for children, adolescents, and also for adults, came up with a number that right now the obesity specific, if you will, expenditures are $226 million. And that's a very, very low bound estimate. And I wanted to be as conservative as possible, right? And so a lot of my thinking about the report was I wanted everything to be defensible. I wanted everything to be transparent. And then I wanted to make sure that this is something that makes sense to the average reader that doesn't have a background, right? And so a lot of the assumptions were let's make sure that we're just as transparent as possible and as conservative as possible. And so, so once we did that, that was essentially right now the stock of excess medical costs. We calculated those. The next part of it was let's age the cohort of 2 to 19-year-olds forward, right? And so we have a certain number of people who are aged between 2 and 19. Those people have certain obesity rates, right? So the obesity rate for that particular group right now is 15.2%. And I said, all right, let's age this cohort forward in order to understand over 20 years, if we were to follow the current cohort of 2 to 19-year-olds for 20 years and calculate their medical expenditures as they age, and then bring those medical expenditures back to the present, meaning in order to generate actually in today's dollars, the overall excess medical costs attributable to obesity, I find that just for that one cohort, and that's really important, there is basically $624 million that is being spent on that cohort by itself over the next 20 years. And that's, you know, in today's dollars, if we're to just age one cohort, and again, I keep repeating just one cohort because the reality is, think about it, every 5 years, it's not going to change. Every 5 years, there is a new cohort that comes in, right? Mm-hmm. And so basically the cycle has the potential of repeating itself over and over. And so there are some pre-specific assumptions that we undertake. So the parameters, if you will, are essentially how many of these kids are currently obese, and then the persistence rate or the transition rate, right? And so how many of the obese children become obese adults? How many of the non-obese children and or adolescents become actually obese adults? And then we just multiply, once again, the number of the obese by the respective costs.
Yeah, so there's a number of questions that come up. One, I mean, those would seem like very reasonable kinds of things. Or assumptions to make. So let's start talking about some of the assumptions. One is, you know, when I look back at it, and again, please don't hesitate to say, yeah, you're wrong. It looks like somewhere around 1970, the obesity rate took off. So we don't have a long period of time at looking at what's happening at obesity overall. I guess my understanding is maybe it's stabilizing now a little bit. So we're able to say that maybe this is over. This is the overall long-term effect. But there could be some changes in the effects over time. It could get worse than where we are.
Absolutely. I think that it's... So the evidence, there is nothing in the data, there is nothing in my work that suggests that we've started reversing the 30-year trend to which you refer, right? And so technological advancement plays a role or has played a role in the increase of obesity, as you've stated earlier, right? And so assuming that it's stabilized or it's going to go forward, now I make no assumptions that the rates are actually going to keep increasing, right? And so, again, I come back to it being a lower bound estimate. It's a starting point that says if everything else were to stay the same and we're to just age this one cohort going forward, here is what we can potentially expect. Now, is there potential that certain things will change in 20 years or 40 years? Absolutely. I did some sensitivity analysis to get to your point about let's make sure that these overall estimates are actually fairly robust, if you will, if I were to change, for example, my discount rate, if I were to change some of the assumptions that I made. And the reality is, I think that the message that's important to communicate is that the point estimate in my mind is not terribly important, meaning the actual number that we produce is not as important as communicating the information, which is obesity costs a lot of money. Savings from even small changes can actually be quite substantial. And so whether it's 10 million or 13 million is not really as important as the fact that the underlying message still stays the same, right? Can something happen in the next 20 years and we all of a sudden eradicate bad eating habits? I don't know. Potentially, I don't see it happening, but it's certainly an option.
The arguments that some I've heard is that, well, my kid's not really obese. He's got big bones. So there is no – I think of it as there's no perfect description or definition of obesity. You use a body mass index. It's not perfect. You're going to say it's not perfect, but it's adequate, it's as good as anything we've got, and it's been stable so we can compare over longitudinal periods of time the kids using the same criteria.
Yeah, I think that you've stated it very well. It's far from ideal. Body composition does not come into it, right? And so it's essentially a weight in kilograms over height in meters squared, right? And so it's it's a little bit of a rough measure. It is, however, something that's been consistent, and it's important to remind listeners that for adults, we don't make adjustments for age. For children and adolescents, we do, right? And so an obese child is somebody that is in the 95th percentile of his age and gender. And so it's because children and adolescents obviously grow very quickly, it's relative to the weight of that particular person's age and gender. And so it's far from ideal, but it's a measure that is readily available. Again, I say readily available, and yet we don't have in Alaska age and gender specific weight data either, right? And so I had to actually generate in a way using national statistics and making certain assumptions to come back to the percent of kids by age and gender who are actually obese. So even that measure is not as readily available as others that are a lot more costly to collect.
So let's ferret that out just a little bit for listeners who may be wondering about that factor. So what we have is we have good national information on height, weight, gender, BMI, and so forth. And we have certain states that we have that information. What we don't have is specific to Alaska. So in a sense, you have to adjust that somewhat.
Yeah, so go ahead.
No, go ahead.
There is no survey that has state representative survey that has weight or BMI for each age and gender separately, right? So, for example, the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey has, it's a state representative survey, and it has BMI for adolescents or children and adolescents between the ages of 10 and 17, right? So we do have that. But we don't know what is the actual obesity rate for kids between 6 and 9.
Okay. All right.
And even in that 10 to 17, that's a pretty big range, right? Right. We don't have the 10 to 13. We don't have the 13 to 16. Mm-hmm. And as a result, that makes making decisions about, you know, a report like this one quite challenging. And so my decision was, okay, we know what the 10 to 17 rate is in Alaska. We know what the 10 to 17 rate is nationally, right? And so let's look, let's create a ratio, if you will, about relative to the U.S. as a whole, what is our 10 to 17 obesity rate? And then let's use that ratio to adjust the national statistics that are available at a more refined level.
How about the costs? You mentioned in your state you used a method by, I assume, an economist named Finkelstein. Mm. How do you go about figuring out what the costs are of healthcare? This gets extremely complex.
Yeah, so there is, they use the medical expenditure panel survey, right? And so in most of these studies, it helps a lot when you have longitudinal data, right? And so mm-hmm. medical expenditure panel survey is a data set that essentially asks a number of questions about health utilization. It asks questions about socioeconomic characteristics and also about weight and height. And so in that data set, one essentially has how much an individual spends on healthcare expenditures. They also have the kind of insurance the individual has and their weight status. And so using regression methods, you're able to basically estimate how much of the overall health utilization is obesity responsible for. And so they come up with what they call obesity attributable fractions, which are essentially how much less would expenditures, health expenditures be if all of the obese individuals were non-obese. And they generate those by type of payer, meaning private payer, Medicare, Medicaid. Mm. And so it's an exercise that leverages the rich data that they have available to them in order to generate these cost differentials. Now, of course, we had to use some sort of average because of the methodology and the paucity of data I was referencing earlier. We opted to use that differential as a starting point in order to generate essentially statewide numbers. And we used different numbers for children and adolescents whose researchers essentially used not terribly dissimilar methods in order to, again, isolate the obesity attributable expenditures from overall utilization expenditures. And so they were basically finding how much does an obese person spend more on utilization than their non-obese counterpart.
I want to come back and ask what specifically things that are different about Alaska that may have to be considered. And I have a couple other questions. Some of the ideas about what happens to obese teenagers, I think it's important that people understand the long-term risk of them maintaining obesity, which you have some statistics on that. I find this very fascinating, so I appreciate your taking the time. Let me remind listeners again, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. Our local number is 550-8433. Our toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. We have an email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. And I know I have an email that I need to address, but I haven't had the right forum or right situation to do that. We will get to it. After this very short break, we'll continue our discussions of the cost of childhood obesity to Alaskans with Dr. Musin Ghatabi. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
You're listening to Line One, your health connection from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One, your health connection on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back. This is Line One, your health connection from KSKA and Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard. Today's program, we're talking about the economic impact of the newest epidemic facing our country, which is obesity. My guest is Dr. Mohsin Ghatabi. He's the Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Alaska Institute of Social and Economic Research. You can mail questions and comments to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. We'll be here for the next 30 minutes or so. That's line1@alaskapublic.org. Our local phone number, if you'd like to call and ask a question or make a comment, 550-8433. And also remember, we have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. You can also listen to the program, a rebroadcast, between 9 and 10 p.m. on Monday evening. That's a recorded broadcast, so we would not be available to answer questions or take your emails. And you can also always go to alaskapublic.org, find the Line 1 link, and you'll find our archives where you can refer other listeners or review the program again at a later date. I very clearly understand the mechanism by which you did your study. There are some things that are rather unique about Alaska, and perhaps we could ask you to comment on those and how that may have affected your thought process and how you accounted for those. The obvious things that come in is a very small population, a very high health care cost, relative to other states. How are those things accounted for?
Yeah, so we, in terms of the cost, there was really nothing that was Alaska-specific. And so I come back to my statement at the very beginning of the broadcast where I said, I really would like, and this is something I communicated hopefully clearly, when I finished the report, is that these are lower bound estimates. And so rather than, for example, taking that 1429 figure by which obese individuals exceed their non-obese counterparts in terms of medical costs and adjusting it for Alaska spending, I said, you know what, I'm just going to use the U.S. average in order to, again, showcase just how severe these expenditures are, even when you're not taking into account the differential of expenditures. And so just to be clear, right now, for example, Alaska spends about $9,800 per individual on healthcare costs, right? And so the U.S. average is about $6,800. And so those differences are pretty significant. So if we were, I would have been arguably justified in taking that $1,400 and actually multiplying it times the differential in order to say that these are really Alaska-specific numbers. But I wanted this to be a conversation starter, right? And so, and a lower bound estimate. You asked about how is Alaska different? Clearly, remoteness, the characteristics of the population, right, the rurality of some of the places, the difficulty of obtaining care, the availability of water in certain places, all of it affects the types of choices that individuals make and the types of options that individuals have, which then ends up influencing whether it be their nutrition or their physical activity participation. And so, and none of those things really are addressed directly in what we did, because this is a state outlook. And even the statistics that we have available, I come back again to the quality of the data. Many of the surveys that I refer to as state representative have very, very small samples in rural areas, right? And so when we usually talk about state specific surveys, those are surveys that have pretty large Anchorage Fairbanks representation and data that is less than ideal for many of the rural areas. And right now, as things stand, that's not something that's going to change anytime soon, because the cost necessary to collect really good data in a geographically isolated place is prohibitive in most cases.
Another statistic, which I guess I'd have to say I was not aware of, that is certainly disturbing, is we've always tried to figure out where does obesity get going? When can you impact on it? When can you stop it? When can you turn it around? And you make the comment that the evidence is that 86% of boys and 90% of girls who are currently obese, so 9 out of 10 of them, are going to continue to be obese as adults, and that about 20% of girls and boys who are not obese will become obese.
Yeah.
So it's suggesting by the time you're an adolescent, the likelihood of changing whatever the factors are, and there's increasing evidence that what happens early in life has lifelong impacts on health. Well, we've talked about that on this program. That makes sense. It's disturbing, though. So it's hard to turn this ship around.
That's a really good way of stating it. The persistence of obesity, I like to think about it. I mean, the persistence is what's used in academic circles. I really like to think about it in terms of stickiness. It's a sticky, sticky condition that's very hard to reverse. And so, as you've correctly pointed out, habits that are started at an early age are ingrained in one's behavior and have a much higher chance of actually staying with the individual. And so by the time you are an adolescent and by the time you're about to become an adult, reversing some of those well-ingrained habits becomes a lot more challenging. And we see that reversing obesity in adulthood is very infrequent and consistent with the statistics you've cited. A lot of the adolescents end up becoming, a lot of the obese adolescents end up becoming obese adult. One thing that's really important to remember is that as big of a problem as obesity currently is, the majority of the population still is non-obese, right? And so, but because in terms of numbers, they represent the majority of people, although the transition rate, or that rate that you mentioned, mm-hmm. which is 20%, 20% of a big number is a very big number, right? Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, we need to be really aware that we need to do something before, you know, these adolescents become obese adults, i.e. the ones who are obese. We need to make sure that we prevent them mm-hmm. from becoming obese adults. But we also need to be really, really aware that simply concentrating on people that are already obese is not necessarily going to solve the problem.
Yeah, very good point.
Yeah, because that 20% represents a pretty big chunk of the population. And again, those costs that we were talking about earlier are going to be pronounced going forward.
Yeah, so 20% of roughly 75% or so.
Exactly.
Are
exactly.
Going to be obese.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a scary statistic, right? And so it's 20% looks like it's a small number, but then you start thinking about the fact that right now still 70% of the population is non-obese, or 75% is non-obese. And so those numbers become staggering.
When I looked at your report, another thing that caught my attention was that actually the relative costs of childhood obesity to adult obesity is a rather small number, small percentage. As I recall, it was something like a couple hundred million versus 7 million or mm-hmm. something, at least maybe this was Alaska, I don't remember if it's national. So a lot of the costs accumulate over time. And as we get older, what are the reasons for that happening?
The reasons are essentially, so there are obesity-specific costs, right? And so one of the things we mentioned in passing is just the cost of bariatric surgery, for example. But then the more pronounced costs are the result of the fact that obesity, as we've mentioned earlier, is very closely associated with chronic conditions, right? And so being obese makes one considerably more likely to develop diabetes, to develop heart disease. And those are, as you know, conditions that tend to be very costly, and they become more, the complications that arise from those conditions become considerably more pronounced as an individual ages, and they're less able to deal with those consequences. And so the chronic nature of the problems that arise as a result of obesity make them ones that essentially tend to cost a lot more later in life than they do in the present. One caveat, and it's a really important caveat, and again, it's the fact that we only capture the medical cost, right? And so a lot of the literature now is shifting towards what are those indirect costs. And for children specifically, the psychological harm, there is quite a bit of evidence that there are consequences. Bullying, for example, is literature that's being addressed right now that looks at what are those consequences to obesity in children and adolescents. And again, as we know, those are things that have lifelong consequences, right? And so they may not be, we may not be able to capture them at a young age, but they're being encountered at a young age and they have lifelong consequences. And so the social stigma, the isolation, those are all things that end up influencing the trajectory of an individual. And so, yes, children spend, or the obesity attributable expenditures in children tend to be smaller than those of adults. That's because the chronic conditions cost more later in life. However, social stigma, psychological harm, and a number of other indirect costs have lifelong consequences, and interventions at an early stage have a much higher likelihood of potentially changing one's behavior than ones that are undergone later in life.
So we had an email about one of those complications, and let's address this author's question. It says, can you and your guest talk more about the connection between obesity and cancer? So one of the complications of obesity is cancer, just like diabetes or just like arthritis or and complications of those problems. A lot of people, the writer says, a lot of people understand the links between tobacco and cancer, but just aren't aware that the role obesity is playing in raising cancer risk. So are you able to comment on that relationship, or would you rather me do that?
You can certainly go. As a physician, I'm assuming that you have an insight that I probably don't, and so I would be happy to listen to what you have to say.
Yeah, and I'm not sure I know exactly either. My understanding is that obesity is an inflammatory disorder. It is no different than, in a sense, than fighting infection or fighting chronic inflammatory disorders. And when you do that, you begin to have a lot of mediators that increase cell turnover, cell damage, and that's what leads to cancer, is this constant repair, this constant redoing your DNA. And the more you have to do that, and the more other factors are impacting your DNA, these inflammatory mediators, the more likely the DNA makes a mistake, and more cancer is being thought of as a series of mistakes that lead to cell growth that's out of control. And so just one explanation may be that we see more inflammation just purely as a result of obesity. I am not an expert on this question, but that's my effort to try to explain that.
The other thing is there is quite a bit of really good work that shows that obesity is actually more strongly associated with a host of chronic conditions than tobacco and alcohol combined. And so to the extent that it's an inflammatory and it is a mediator of sorts, just that link, or the strength of that link, essentially is going to result in, you know, a host of other chronic conditions, cancer being one of them. The biological explanations are well beyond the scope of the work that I do, but that doesn't surprise me.
So that another question. This leads me, your comment there is to put this into some perspective. It's nice to say, oh, gosh, this costs a lot of money, but lots of things cost a lot of money. How does this compare to smoking-related problems or alcohol, which you brought up, which are all have another commonality, this obesity, this alcohol issue, which we're not talking about specifically, but it's a very big cost to the country, smoking, are all really behavioral problems. They fall out of the realm of the classic healthcare, but healthcare is changing because of this, but they're behaviors that people decide to pursue.
They are risky behaviors, absolutely. The same study that I was talking about a second ago essentially shows that, this is little dated in early 2000s, that an average obese individual spends about 36% more than their non-obese counterpart. A smoker spends about 21% more than their non-obese counterpart, and a severe drinker spends about 14% more than their non-obese counterpart. And so, again, the obese individual spends a lot more than both the smoker and the heavy drinker in isolation. Now, to come back to your point about these being behavioral changes, they indeed are, but our behavioral interacts with the opportunities that are present to us, the environment in which we exist. And so we need to think about it in terms of how can we nudge people to make better decisions, whether that be in terms of allowing them better information to make better nutritional choices. Is it about having an environment that's conducive to physical activity? Is it about providing parents with the information necessary? Because there is a home environment, there is a choice environment in this. But similar to the tobacco policies years ago, it's a multifaceted issue, right? And so there is no silver bullet here. And any sort of solution needs to tackle all of the aspects in which an individual exists, right? That would be the school environment, the home environment, the behavioral choices, and potentially the exposure to which they're being faced. And so, it's not there is no single driver.
It's maybe not directly to the cost, which you've very clearly pointed out are going to be large. And I guess we should say real quickly, or I would like to say real quickly, the more we spend on healthcare issues, the less we have for our infrastructure, which we have for growth, research, education, the whole shebang. So, but I'm trying to think where I was going when my mind changed here. What I was going to say is there is some reason to be optimistic in that we somehow eventually have successfully handled some other large behavioral behavioral epidemics. We've done a good job, maybe not sufficient, but a good job on smoking. We did a good job on, and people don't think about this or realize how much safety of automobiles. More people were dying, I think, in the 50s in automobile accidents than today, and yet there are far, far, far more people in automobiles. So we have addressed some of these issues. I don't think we've addressed alcohol very effectively when I think about it. So maybe there is some hope on the horizon by taking information like this.
It's certainly an interesting comparison. The pushback has been, and I'm going to get a little bit econ hawkish here. The pushback has been from an externality standpoint, right? So the counter argument is all of these things that you mentioned, so smoking, we've intervened not because of the harm that was done to smokers, we intervened because of the harm that's done to secondhand smokers. Driving, it's because of the harm that's being done to the third party that's not actually involved in the reckless driving. The obesity problem is certainly one that is very interesting, and there are certainly a lot of parallels that can be drawn, but a lot of the pushback is is there a case for government intervention, right? Is there a case for policies to potentially reduce obesity? The answer to that is an unequivocal yes, right? Because the costs that you mentioned are ones that are borne by not just the obese individual himself or herself, but those are spread across all sorts of payers. My own work shows that there is an association between obesity and bankruptcy. Again, bankruptcy is part of the safety net, and those costs are spread across all sorts of individuals. Mm-hmm. And so it's no longer an individual problem. It's a societal problem, and therefore there are grounds on which we should be intervening, and we come back to the preventative actions, and we should be investing in those preventative actions in order to avoid some of the same fates that we saw in tobacco and in alcohol. And so, yes, there is optimism. Yes, there is hope. We need to be a little more aggressive in trying to fund preventive actions, because we do know that there are externalities from the obesity epidemic.
And another email I feel like we should address. It says, does your study cover socioeconomic factors such as poverty and its effects on the quality of diet, and how the quality of diet may lead to diabetes, obesity, and so forth?
Yeah, not this specific study. So a lot of my other work uses longitudinal data sets that allow us to control for the socioeconomic characteristics of individuals. This is not an individual level study. And so we use aggregate data. The evidence is obviously that obesity is more pronounced in lower income households. Again, it comes back to the types of nutritional options that are available. It comes back to the environment and whether or not it's more or less conducive to exercise. Neighborhoods, for example, that are more violent, or where there is more violence, tend to see considerably less physical activity by kids than more affluent ones. And so the intricacies or the interconnectedness here between one socioeconomic background, the options that they have available, and the obesity outcomes are certainly worth keeping in mind. This study, however, does not address any of those.
Okay. Jerry, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering, it's quite proven, you know, there is a problem there, an issue. And whenever I talk to my medical care, it's, of course, eat less and eat right and get more exercise. Is there anything in the way of anything medicine-wise, a magic pill, appetite suppressant, anything out there to help along the way there?
Right, yeah. So is there anything interventionally from a medical, purely medical standpoint that would be helpful for this epidemic? I'll go ahead and use the word epidemic.
The diet industry is a multi-billion dollar industry. And so is there something that's being done systematically? I don't know of any magic pill that anybody's come about. What's being found from a research standpoint is that any essentially diet, whether it's a diet pill or actually behavioral changes, they all work if they're done on a consistent basis. I don't know off the top of my head of any. One thing that is actually now really interesting is the effect of these wearable devices, right? And so the role of technology essentially mm-hmm. in affecting mm-hmm. both our nutritional intake and the amount of physical activity. And so from that standpoint, I think that that's a new angle, but I'm not aware of anything new.
Jerry, I've heard of you know, some of the medications that are designed to help you control cholesterol really didn't evolve or have evolved in the way they you metabolize or absorb fats, I think, from the diet. Again, my expertise. And there have been some studies looking at medications similar to this to decrease absorption of foods from the intestinal tract. So again, that would be a medical approach similar to what you're talking about that being looked at.
Well, I'm currently with my medical provider, of course, taking that, just trying it out right now in the beginning stage, 2 weeks, at Belvix. Seems to have a little bit of an effect. I guess I'll take it for the long run and see what actually happens there and if there's any overall improvement, and if it's a mean something that's going to keep it off, you know.
Well, good luck.
Keep the weight. Yeah. Okay, well, thank you.
You'll benefit. Thanks, Jerry. Well, we're kind of in our last 3 minutes or so, and maybe this is a good time for me to let you summarize again, the purpose and the results and what you would feel is how we want to use this data. You've mentioned all of these, but I think that's what we want people to come away from the program remembering, is if anything they can. Yep.
Yeah, this was a study on the current and future medical costs of childhood obesity. And so the steps are essentially, A, to quantify the costs of obesity in Alaska in 2012, and to try and get a sense of how much it actually costs if we were to age a specific cohort of children over 20 years. And so, again, to get an idea about the size of the problem from a monetary standpoint. And hopefully this informs decision-making, in that I think that we're not going to be able to change how much money is allocated to anti-obesity policies until we frame this issue of cost properly. And hopefully this plays a role in explaining to policymakers that there are significant benefits to investing in preventative policies, because the cost of doing nothing is unsustainable. And there are significant benefits, monetary ones, in the long run to investing today in policies that have the a high likelihood of reversing that trend.
Okay. Well, listen, Dr. Maseen Ghatabi is our guest today, and I want to say thanks for taking the time to do that. It's been informative. I think anybody who's listens carefully realizes the importance of doing this kind of information, and you taking the time and somebody helping support that. So I'm nice that the health department is working on another epidemic to try to approach. So we appreciate everybody's efforts.
Yeah.
If you'd like to continue the conversation on the economic impact of childhood obesity, you can join KSKA on Facebook. You can find that link at our website, www.alaskapublic.org, where you can also find our Line 1 archives. And also let us know while you're there about thoughts and suggestions at our email at line1@alaskapublic.org. The next program, our guest is going to be pediatric dermatologist Dr. Gina Brown. We'll be discussing acne, eczema, something about birthmarks, perhaps, and answering any of your questions on skin care and skin disorders, perhaps even talking some more about why teens got to be careful about tanning and the consequences of that over the long term. So why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, June 1st at 2 p.m. Remember, we repeat that same evening at 9 p.m. on FM 91.1 KSKA at Alaska Public Media. Pat Yak is our chief content officer at Alaska Public Media. Dave Waldron is our web editor and helped engineer today's program. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.